even though the spark comes from within, you have to work with a team, you know, whether it's engineers or clients or builders, and kind of shepherd that vision along.
This is the Sparkcast, a bi-weekly show where we explore the creativity, technology, and business of CG. I'm your host, Marina Antunes.
By his own admission, Wilson Tang's career path has been anything but linear, but one constant has guided his choices: change. Beginning his career as an architect, his passion for design and the urge to create worlds led Wilson to leap into animation, a step in his career that would make him the ideal candidate for industrial light and magic. Just when he thought he'd made it, his itch to try something new led him to Electronic Arts to build and lead the Need for Speed team. The advent of cellular phones and the growing mobile gaming market caught Wilson's attention, and in 2010, he co-founded Exploding Barrel Games, a mobile game studio that proved so successful that it was acquired by Kabam in 2013. After over a decade in the gaming industry, Wilson has taken on his next project, this time in the evolving landscapes of AR and VR. In our conversation, Wilson shares the strategic vision that guides Yumibao and the potential for immersive technology to shape our future. He shares insights into the future of VR, offering creative tips for those looking to stay ahead in the industry amidst the rise of AI and other emerging technologies. He also reflects on the significance of creativity and the invaluable lessons he hopes to pass down to future generations, emphasizing the importance of nurturing one's artistic passions and the power of collaboration. Here's our conversation with Wilson Tang.
I wanted to start by asking you, like, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Hong Kong and then moved to Toronto when I was 9. Yeah, it was a little bit of a culture shock in the beginning, but ended up in the suburb of Toronto when I was about 9 years old.
Were you always a creative person? Like, were you a creative kid?
I was told by my mom that I wouldn't have survived in Hong Kong because I was a little bit too creative. I was in a boys' school, private school, I think. My mom just kind of pulled the plug and said, you know, I don't think you're going to make it here. So I think that's how I ended up in Toronto, Canada. That's what I've been told.
Do you remember your first sort of like encounter with the creative field? Like when you were young, like were there movies or TV that inspired you and you were like, maybe that's something I want to do? Or was it just like you just like to draw?
No. Growing up in Hong Kong, there was no role model. There was no such thing as a creative field. And remember, I'm a little bit older. So like back then it was early 70s, mid 70s, sorry. You know, there was no such thing as like animation as a career path or computer graphics or video games, and none of that exists. But I was always drawn to Japanese culture, Japanese pop culture. So I do remember, you know, in Hong Kong in the 70s, you know, we'd be exposed to some manga and definitely some anime, some of the classic ones like, you know, Astro Boy. And these were like reruns that was sold to territories like Hong Kong. So I think I've always been enamored with Japanese pop culture.
And so you're in Toronto, you're growing up as a young kid, you're starting to discover, I'm sure, pop culture is a little more accessible in Toronto. At that point, like, were you curious or interested at all in art? Or like, so you went to school for architecture when push came to shove?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, that's really, you know, I was, you know, one of those guys that are, you know, love science as well, science and math. And I always kind of drew on the side. And it turns out actually later on in life, I started realizing I did probably get it from my mom and dad who, you know, from their generation, there was never a thought that you can pursue a career in art. So they just kind of did it as a hobby. For me, it was just something I always did. You know, I remember being around 12 or 13 and, you know, doing some drawings and everybody be like, oh, you're an artist. And I don't know if that always sat, I'm not sure right why, but I always didn't see consider myself an artist, even though I considered my drawing skill as a skill, as a communication skill. That's what I tell people. It's kind of served me well because, you know, like I, you know, being an architect and then, you know, as you know, I kind of, you know, animation and film and games, but through it all, I still doodle and sketch and I do it just to communicate ideas. I think that's what that's how I use my artistic skills.
So when you decided that you wanted to do study architecture, was the plan to be an architect?
Yeah, I was actually an architect for, I would say, 3 years. Going through school, we were lucky because we, got to travel around a little bit with the class. I ended up in, this would have been fourth year or third year. I was in Rome with the school and then with the class. And then just before that, I had entered a industrial design competition for Sony, just on a lark with a friend. And we ended up winning, and they flew us from Rome to Japan. And then I had my portfolio with me. So I knocked on a door of an architect I really admired. His name is Shintaro Matsu. And to this day, I consider myself, I consider him to be my mentor and sensei, even though, it's been a long, long time since I worked with him. I knocked on his door and got an internship. And I think that actually a lot of things kind of flower from that. And, when I ended up in Lucasfilm, and we'll talk about it later, the reason I think I got that job was because they knew I worked for Takamatsu, which back in the mid to late 90s, Takamatsu was a really well-known architect.
So you get an internship there. Do you stay in Japan or do you come back and finish school and work in Canada as an architect?
So I was in Kyoto for a year, which was amazing. That was an internship while I was going through school. And then I worked with the architect one more year in Berlin because he opened an office in Berlin. That was still as a student. And then after I graduated, I went back to Japan, but that was now switching into animation. So that would have been in the kind of mid-90s.
Let's talk about the switch. You're an architect, you're working at an architecture firm with, your mentor, somebody you really admire, doing work that you're really proud of. What prompts you to kind of look at animation as something that you wanted to do? Like, how did this even come about?
Well, I think if I, I think if I grew up in maybe LA or California or one of those places where the entertainment industry was a lot bigger, I think I would probably, or if the schools had something called, now they have entertainment design, I think some schools, I probably would have gone down that path. I've always, loved movies, even as a teenager, and especially sci-fi. So I still consider Blade Runner to be my favorite movie. I think some of that kind of rubbed off on me all the times. The architects I did choose to work for example, Takamatsu, if you look him up, his stuff, it looks like it's from the future. Like it's not a normal building by any means. And that's partially why I think, when I went to Lucasfilm and Industrial Light and Magic, they kind of recognized that name. But anyways, I think I probably, always loved films, always loved world building. And I think, if I look back to some of the architecture projects I did in school, they tend to be on the fantastic side. So I don't think I was ever born to be an architect, even though I kind of like the skills. And I think it taught me actually quite a few really important skills, some of which is, present your ideas and working with a group. And, even today, actually last week I was telling my team that I think that's really what it comes down to, the difference between an artist and an architect. Artist is a really, soul kind of personal endeavor and really comes from within. I think to be a great architect, even though the spark comes from within, you have to work with a team, whether it's engineers or clients or builders, and kind of shepherd that vision along. And I think that has always stayed with me. So I think that training as an architect really kind of allowed me to cross between different industries very well. And through the years, I have met a lot of other ex-architects that moved into entertainment as well.
So you're in Japan, you're getting into the entertainment industry. Did you have a job when you went there, or did you just kind of go to check things out and see what you can make of it?
The first one was when I knocked on the door because I got the free trip. The second time was through a friend, and a friend had heard that there was a studio opening up in Sapporo, Japan. So actually myself and my wife, but my girlfriend at the time, we both moved away from architecture, moved to Sapporo, and worked on animation and video games there for a couple of years. And then, this is the story where it connects to, I think, your favorite project, Tekken on Kinkreed, my favorite project. After 2 years, I was like, I've had enough of Northern Japan. We were about to leave. And, back then, Softimage was a very important and very cutting-edge piece of software. And it's still, I still think it's probably one of the most, most amazing, well-designed piece of software ever made. So we were in Northern Japan using Softimage, and there was a group of, I kind of call them the SWAT team of Softimage. They were called special projects that kind of went around the world, kind of supporting studios to integrate Softimage. And the team member, the main one in Japan, was a guy named Michael Arias, and he was in Tokyo at the time. So towards my last stint, like towards the end of my stay in Sapporo, Japan, we crossed paths with Mike, and we became really good friends. And Mike is a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant guy. Left brain, right brain, amazing director, of course, but just a brilliant guy. And he's like, "Hey, I'm thinking of starting something in Tokyo. You want to, join in?" And that's how we were pulled into the anime industry in Tokyo. Got to work with Mike, got to work with the director at that time, which is Morimoto Koji, who's a legend. He was animation director on, Akira, as well as Memories, one of the best short in Memories. He's just a brilliant anime director. So that's kind of how that door kind of shut and another door opened in Tokyo.
And how long did you end up working in Tokyo before you kind of made your way back to North America?
L A little bit less than 2 years. And that was a, purely for Tekkon Concrete, the pilot. And Mike, had pulled together a little bit of funding from Sega, especially a really well-known game designer, producer named Tatsuya Mizuguchi, who was a big name in gaming. He still is. He's a legend. So Tatsuya Mizuguchi backed us. Mike brought in Matsumoto Taiyo, who's the mangaka, the manga artist behind these Tekkon Concrete, and then brought in Morimoto Koji as the director. And that was going to be one of the first full 3D anime to be made in Japan. So the studio was about, I don't think there was more than eight of us. And we painted, we built, we staffed it up, tiny, two floors, tiny floors in Harajuku, which is a really great area in Tokyo. And that was an amazing time. And to this day, I think that was my favorite moment of my career. We did a pilot, I think it was less than 10 minutes long. And then we got to take it to, Comic-Con, to Annecy, and, build a little bit of buzz. And I would love to seen it, follow it through, but, towards the end of that process, we weren't quite sure if that was going to get picked up, and I had a few interviews lined up, and they were, headhunting. Lucas, Industrial Light Magic was starting something up, so yet again, another door opened up.
The opportunity comes up to go to ILM and work at Lucasfilm. Can you say, like, what projects were they kind of looking at the time that got you so interested that you were willing to take this chance and leave behind a project you were clearly super passionate about and are still really passionate about? Because I know you've talked about Tekkon Concrete quite a bit, even with us. What was it that was calling to you at ILM?
In terms of career path, I always knew that that was the peak. I loved anime, but I wasn't quite sure if I wanted to live in Japan for more than, by that point, I would have lived there probably about 6 years in total. So that was kind of like getting up to the, that crucial point, like either I stay there forever or, start a different career path in a different, very prestigious place like, Industrial Light & Magic. So the project was for an animated feature called Frankenstein. And back then, I don't know if this is really well known or not, but I don't think it's a big secret. But, George and Industrial Light & Magic was the where Pixar started. Probably, I don't know, early 90s, I guess. I don't know when he sold it. He decided that, computer animation, wasn't going to fly. So he got rid of it. He sold it to Steve Jobs. But then, of course, by the end of 98, 99, we started seeing some of the great examples come from Pixar and DreamWorks. Bug's Life, Toy Story was coming out, had come out already. So Lucasfilm and George was once again interested in computer animated features. So, Frankenstein was going to be the first one, even though I think that was a Universal. It wasn't George's production, but Industrial Light Magic was interested in it. So they needed somebody who, could basically bridge the gap between, concept art, world building, and 3D. And I had both of those in my arsenal. I can draw, I can design spaces and worlds, but also I can do 3D. And, for Tekkon Concrete, we pretty much built a whole mini city with a team of four people, probably. So it was just they saw that and kind of like was very interested in having me kind of help them flesh out the sets for Frankenstein.
And you were there for a number of years before you moved on.
I don't know if it's good luck or bad luck, but within about the second month, they pulled the plug on Frankenstein. And so it's like, okay, what do I do now? But luckily, I had my portfolio with me once again, and knocked on the door in the art department, and the rest was history. And they took me in, and went from a few smaller projects to some of the bigger ones. And yeah, I was there for about 7 years, I think.
And I think it's worth mentioning because you kind of mentioned this in passing right at the beginning, but when you moved to Japan, you were with your girlfriend at the time, and eventually she became your wife. So it's not like you're just moving around from project to project, thinking only of yourself. Now you have a family to consider as well. Is it hard to make these decisions?
When you're in your 20s, I don't think it's hard. When I hear young, creatives or artists kind of ask me these questions, like, I want to, like, oh, I want to stay here because I'm 23 and I want to make my career, and I don't want to travel. I don't want to, like go to somewhere where the job opportunity might not be there, or, but it, and I always tell them, like, if you're in your 20s, you should always travel. Like, honestly. So it wasn't a hard decision at all. And my girlfriend at the time, Leslie Fulton, who's my wife and mother of my kids, it turned, luckily enough, she went from architecture to animation, and she's still working in animation today for Industrial Light & Magic. And so I think it was a little bit of luck, a little bit of, just never being afraid of taking a step towards something that's interesting and fun,
And I mean, your time at ILM, you worked on some really like key projects, like one of the Star Wars films, AI, which I think might be one of Spielberg's best. Don't tell anybody. But I mean, you certainly had you were working with on some really great big projects. What was for you the highlight of working at ILM?
Well, I was pretty lucky, and but at the time, you never know. And actually, I think I tended to work on projects that almost like nobody else wanted to work on, or none of the other art directors was really want to work on, like the weird ones. So the Hulk with Ang Lee was kind of a little bit weird. It wasn't spaceships and robots. I did, work on Star Wars a little bit, I think about 7 or 8 months. And then AI was also a little bit weird too, right? It wasn't Spielberg 100%, it was Kubrick. And I think the story was not, on the page, it didn't seem like a blockbuster. When I say weird, I mean blockbusters, right? ILM is known for family, mass appeal blockbusters, Ghostbusters, Star Wars, things like that. So on paper, I think I tend to get the slightly more, I would say, artistic ones. And I don't know if that's by luck or deliberate, I'm not sure. For AI, I was actually the first person, I believe, in the world to use a game engine for a previs. And I convinced Dennis Muren, who's a 11-time Oscar winner, Dennis Muren, to kind of let me go for it. And I was a gamer when I was a kid. That was the rise of kind of game engines and mods. So for AI, not only did I design parts of the city, I convinced Dennis to give me a programmer. And we modded a game engine to allow Steven Spielberg to walk around Rouge City on his laptop in a custom application that I designed, and we got built. So from that, I got an invite to present at the ranch, and I had no idea what to expect. All I knew was like, George is throwing something together and come up with this thing, come up with your previous tool and present at the ranch. That was 2003, I think. So I kind of knew George was going to be there. So I knew he really loved Seven Samurai. So I spent about a week, me and my buddy, and we studied Seven Samurai and kind of reproduced it as a kind of low res animated master sequence. And then we, polished up the tool so that you can shoot in real time this master sequence. The day of, I got a call. I drove up with my laptop and I tripled, I don't know, I checked that it was still running, like literally 50 times. I did not know how, who was going to be there, but I knew George was going to be there. So I got up to Skywalker Ranch, opened the door, and standing beside me was Scorsese, Coppola, Spielberg, Michael Mann, Michael Bay, Rodriguez, Bryan Singer, Lasseter, Ed Catmull, and nobody else. It was just like 2 day, what George called the digital summit. And no, there was no publicity, no producers, no managers. It was just them at George's, little house up in the hill. George was trying to basically present to his friends how filmmaking will be completely changed with digital tools. That's when it happened. And he called all his friends in. And then so I, got up on stage in front of these 30, essentially Hollywood who's who, and presented the previous tool. And it worked, and it was, got a lot of questions. And I think that was definitely my highlight. And I couldn't really talk about it for at least 15, 20 years because I signed an NDA. And I've got one picture from it that I got back from Lucasfilm. And he's like, you can't show this anybody for like whatever, 15 years or something. But that was definitely the highlight. That was phenomenal. And just to see George hang out with his buddies, like they were just like a bunch of, Hollywood, sorry, a bunch of film students. Like they were arguing about movies and what George was doing. And there's a lot of camaraderie and, just a bunch of filmmakers. And that's really amazing to see.
And I actually wanted to ask you about that tool because you patented that tool as well, right?
I think ILM applied for a patent for it. It was, pretty early. That was like 2003, I think, 2004.
Yeah, because I mean, this was way before we started talking about, real time rendering and real time engine and all of this stuff. I mean, we're talking like 20 years before this was ever a thought in anybody else. So I'm curious, what was it that kind of even spawned the concept for you? To like marry these two things together. Like, what was going through your mind when you were like, like, were you playing a game and you're like, I wonder, because that's really thinking outside the box.
When I try to explain people like how I got here or there, it doesn't really make any sense. What there's no career path that allows you to follow what I did, right? So it's all outside the box. And I think I do, like looking back, I do tend to have this habit of, jumping to something that I don't know. Sorry, jumping into something new, putting myself into it, after a couple of years getting bored with it, learning the next thing, and then jumping into something new again, right? So that's, architecture to computer graphics to anime to games to, VR. So it's kind of like it's always gone these kind of leaps. So, but specifically at the art department at ILM back in early 2000s, we had a group of mostly guys that were playing first person shooters every Friday night, and we would stay around after work on movies. And these are artists, these are all artists. And then, like, 6 or 7 o'clock rolls around, and then everybody would come to the art department and we'd start playing Quake. And we'd put $20 in, everybody put $20 each in the pool, and somebody walks away with $200 every Friday. And that's, we still talk about it with my buddies there. So I think, it's the way my brain works is always like looking for the next cool thing. And I think that was part of it. Like, we were making films, and this is like after about 2 or 3 years. And, I think I have, right or wrong, I have a big enough ego to kind of like after 2 years go, they're doing stuff wrong here. It's so inefficient. And I'm at like ILM, like who am I, right? And it's like after about 2 or 3 years, like, I think they're really inefficient. Why are we drawing pictures and then building 3D and then getting storyboards and then roughing it out as animatics and then getting feedback to the director and then making changes? Why don't I just collapse all that stuff, give a rough set, put in the hands of the director, which I still believe to this day. I think in some ways the process of CG dismediated the people who really should be moving the camera around. And I think that's why the first 20 years of or 15 years of CG driven cinema felt so lifeless because the people designing shots, moving cameras around, was not the director, nor was it a cinematographer. So I think there was something lost. So when I did this tour, I do remember saying that to a group at Skywalker Ranch, to George and his friends. I said, I want to put the power back in your hands, literally.
Your next leap is into gaming, which is not, a huge leap from where you were developing. You developed this tool. So, you come to Vancouver to EA. What was it about gaming at that point that was really interesting to you?
My first love was actually arcade games. Like I spent way too much time playing Asteroids and Defender and Q-Bert and all these arcade games in the 80s. So I think I kind of said to myself, like, one day I think the graphics will get better, and when the time comes, maybe I'll switch to gaming. So I started seeing that happen in towards my last year at Industrial Light & Magic, right? So the 2004, 2006, I believe that's when PlayStation 2 came out and started seeing what was possible with real-time graphics. And so when the EA started calling, came calling, I didn't think I would make a move. And I kind of like, they said, what would it take? And I, just said, this is what it would take. And they said, okay. And I go, okay, well, I guess I'm going to gaming. So yeah, I think my wife and others thought I was crazy. It's like, you're leaving Industrial Light & Magic? Like, what are you doing? And again, that's one of those, like, another kind of crazy leap. It's just, I followed my instinct, I guess. It was more interesting to me, and I was kind of like, like starting to get bored with the business of VFX. So I think that's another through line. It's like I get antsy and I start asking myself not just about the job, but the entire business of that thing that I'm involved in. And I start seeing how it could be better or where it can go or whether it has a future. And then I start looking elsewhere. And so it's kind of like that was another big leap, I think.
And so when you end up in Vancouver, you're working for with Need for Speed, which is at the time was like one of the biggest titles out there for gaming.
Yeah, and I drive a Prius. I was like, dude, what are you doing? You drive a Prius and you work on Need for Speed. And yeah, I'm not really a car guy, but I did like the world building aspects of it. It was a big learning curve, actually. And I think after, and I've seen a lot of art directors and creatives and artists either make that switch from film to games or wanting to make that switch. And I think usually they come with a little bit of a chip on the shoulder. But having now been in interactive and gaming for, no, more than 15 years, 20, 18 years. It challenges me in a way that has never really kind of stopped. Like there's always something new to learn. The technology and the people and the business always evolves and changes. And so it's always like I think it's something that I finally found to be challenging enough to keep me interested. I think with EA at that time, the leap to higher graphics fidelity really needed people like me and others, like Habib Sargapour, who's another one, a great friend of mine's also made that leap. Really needed that eye, but also the understanding of, lighting and shaders and geometry and design to really kind of create worlds that suit these next generation games.
You worked at EA for a number of years before you took your next step. And I think this is interesting because this kind of marks the beginning of your entrepreneurship. I mean, clearly you've always been looking for the next challenge. That seems to be a theme. And you're there for a few years before you move into mobile gaming. What prompted you to co-found Exploding Barrel Games? Because I think this is interesting for folks that might not remember. I mean, 2010 was the era of iPhone 4, and like BlackBerry was still a thing. Google had a Nexus phone. I mean, this is early days, and I think like the most popular games at the time were Angry Birds. Like this was the epitome of like mobile gaming, and here you come from, the perhaps arguably the at the time the biggest game studio in the world, working on some of the biggest titles with the highest, like the highest fidelity imaging to an iPhone 4 game.
Yeah, people again thought I was crazy. So you've actually like at that point it's like, wait a minute, you went from the big screen, like the silver screen, to a smaller screen, which is console gaming, to a tiny screen. That's the trajectory of your career. And yeah, once again, it didn't really make sense. But I always wanted to be an entrepreneur, even though I didn't really have any role model. You know, my parents were not business people. And you know, I grew up as an artist, and all my friends were, you know, either nerds or artists. And I don't think I really had a role model, but something was eating away inside me. Like, you know, I was saying, like, whatever discipline I was in, whatever industry I was in, eventually I would ask those big questions about the macro question of that industry, the business, and how it's run, and the people, and you know, where it's going. Like, eventually I end up asking those questions. So when in 2006, when I left EA and co-founded Exploding Barrel Games, you know, I was, you know, I'm one of the few, I think, artists that looked at, I love charts. I think I've read every issue of Wired magazine since its inception. So I was a big tech nerd, I think. So seeing the growth of these little screens in your back pocket, also have some friends in Silicon Valley as well. So seeing that growth, if you project that out, you know, the small, even though the screens were small, the impact on the world, the fact that we all carry one in a back pocket, was clear even at that point. So I was up for the challenge, and you know, it was actually a really tough first couple of years. I did a lot of pitches for, you know, other people's IPs, and actually the studio really didn't get its grounding until we did a deal with Jimmy Buffett and the song Margaritaville. Our first big game was Margaritaville. And you know, so weird, and for me anyways, it's like, what are you doing? But you know what, I look back on it, and we all love working on it. We actually kind of miss it. You can build your own bar, you can go fishing, you can go limbo dancing, and it was all in this little game. So you know, I don't know, it doesn't make sense, Marina, but you know, we enjoyed it.
Okay, so now you're clearly like in the gaming world and you've seen the opportunities that there are in mobile gaming. Talk about Kabam and how that venture came to be.
We were acquired by Kabam, right? So when you start a company, you know, obviously there's three outcomes. One is you go belly up. Second one is you stay independent and, you know, relatively small, I guess. Or you go public. And then the third one is you get snapped up by somebody. So I think this was 2010, I believe. It was only about 4 years, I think. I think we were, you know, talking to Kabam. They were started in San Francisco. And at that point, we saw the inflection point wherein it wasn't good enough to have, you know, Angry Birds, or even Flappy Birds on a mobile phone. People were looking for something that's a little bit more high quality. So I think, you know, Kabam heard about us. We were positioning ourselves as a kind of what we call triple A mobile games, which was a pretty unique position. And you know, luckily we chose to use the Unity engine and all that stuff. So I think when, you know, just everything lined up, and I think we were acquired about 2010, and then we started working on what became our most successful game and still successful game, called Marvel Contest of Champions.
Aside from Marvel, I mean, you guys also worked on Transformers. And I wanted to ask you about the Alibaba deal, because that seems like it was a big deal.
I think it was there's a few people down in Kabam in SF that was you know, really good at putting deals together. So I think we did Fast and Furious 6, the game, and then Transformers and Marvel Contest Champions at the same time, I believe. So at some point anyway, I was kind of overseeing all the games that was being done in the studio. And you know, that was, you know, interesting because that's the first time when I had such a direct input on product and mentoring and growing the team. And I think to this day, I think, you know, I think the Kabam art team, you know, was probably one of the best teams I ever, not including the current team I have, but you know, one of the better teams I've had. And they were phenomenal, and it wasn't very large. I think at their largest, including UI and UX and characters and worlds and everything, I think we were like maybe 40, 50, 40 people, maybe at most, supporting like two or three pretty big games.
So when does AR become a thing for you? Because it's still within the whole mobile future when you think about it.
AR and VR, like all the R's for, I guess it was 2017 when Oculus was bought by Meta. So, okay, full circle, right? Like I told you, I was a sci-fi nerd. Even before movies, I was a sci-fi, huge sci-fi reader. And the one book that I still read, and I've been lucky to become kind of friends with the author a little bit, is Neuromancer. I love William Gibson. I love Neuromancer. I love his short story, Burning Chrome. So the idea of virtual reality was something that's always been part of me since my teenage years. Now, what became, if you actually look at it within my lifetime, within your lifetime, Rena, it became a science fiction idea to something you saw on the big screen as a fleshed out idea to something that, hey, it's for real now, right? So I think I tell people that I've been waiting for the rise of immersive for my entire life. And it combines everything I've ever done, world building, interaction, gameplay, architecture, all of it, right? So I'm finally kind of happy. So AR is really just a stepping stone. So I think we've kind of really, I really took the long road because I tell people Yumabao is really my last company. And I didn't really want to do it in a way that forced my hand in anything. I knew from 7, 8 years ago that it was going to be a long road. There's a lot of things beyond my control as a small studio, hardware being one of them. And hardware is really, really hard. And I knew that. I understand technology to know that that stuff is hard. To get it on your face, to be comfortable, to project a whole world, to have hand tracking without any additional hardware, this stuff is hard. So for me, I plot out a really long path. So AR was a stepping stone. So even though it uses all the same underlying technology, I think techniques, Unity, hand tracking, world anchors, all that stuff that you need to do through AR, I always thought that the form factor of a little on a tiny little screen wasn't really the end point. So over the last 2 years, we've transitioned from AR to almost fully VR. And I think now with, I think starting from Quest 3, we are now seeing the beginning of, I think, what truly is a consumer level VR device. And so, I think we're pretty well positioned for that.
So talk a little bit about some of the projects that you're working on, because one of the things that I think is really interesting is your work covers not just, world building in the sense of entertainment, but also in the sense of education, of learning, of the full immersive spectrum.
Yeah, that was, it's opportunistic in some ways, but also I think when I started the this, Yumabao, my last company, with some, with a few people, I wanted to do it right. And I did have a value, I want to be a kind of values-based company that said, whatever we do is going to be good for kids, good for people, right? And I think that's important because I, if you remember, with the rise of VR, I think everybody just immediately makes that leap as dystopian. Like, kids are going to be locked into their headset and, never engage with the world. And I was really painfully aware of that. So I think it was important to kind of put my a stake in the sand in the beginning and said, we're going to do good VR, right? Do good AR, good VR. And what did that translate to? That was a lot of early opportunities with museums, art galleries, and they were interested in the cutting edge. So yeah, that really kind of helped as a studio, as a design studio. At this moment in time, I wanted to have that body of work to define us. Now, from this point on, we are doing stuff that's more gamey, I would say. That's kind of, that's also, who I am and who the team is. And so I think that's that's our future. But the games that we're doing is definitely not, you know, hopefully it'll be, you know, it'll be good for kids as well.
You talk a little bit about how you recognize that the hardware was going to be something that was going to be coming slowly. And to me, as someone that is only vaguely aware of the space, it seems like we went from the first Oculus to where we are today with the new Apple headset was like this ginormous leap forward. And it seems like with every leap, it gets even more advanced. For you, what do you think is the future of like where are we going with VR? Like, what does, 5 years down the line look like?
Well, like in some ways, everything we're building is already 5 years down the line. I think it will disrupt everything. School, museums, games, movies, shopping. So it does have that ability to disrupt everything. And you know, when I let me put on my startup entrepreneur hat on, like usually you try to, you know, answer that question. It's like if you're gonna start a business and start a new company, you want to say, okay, what is the value? What is the problem that you're trying to solve, right? If you're not really solving a problem, then it's like NFTs, like you don't really need it, right? It doesn't solve anybody's problems. I don't think anybody else has kind of talked about it this way, but I think our physical world is designed really poorly. I think the problem that VR solves is our poorly designed physical world that's auto-dependent. At the end of the day, we are all social creatures. And the fact that if you want to engage online with somebody, the fact that we're doing over Zoom is an intermediate step. It's not going to be like that. You have to believe that this is not going to be forever. So what is the next thing? Well, to be in a room with you as a, you know, wherever you are, Marina, and wherever I am, and we're like, you know, I don't know, playing chess together and pointing out, you know, I'm showing you drawings from my archive. I'm looking, you know, drawing stuff on the wall, you're checking it out, we're playing games at the same time, and then your mother calls, and your mother, wherever she is a hologram because she doesn't want to leave Florida. I'm assuming, I'm not saying your mother's in Florida. And she appears as a hologram because she doesn't fly anymore, but she's, you know, like we are social animals. We want to get together, but traveling is really a pain in the ass. And it's a huge carbon footprint as well, cars and automotive and airplanes. So I think that's a fundamental problem that potentially VR solves. So 5 years from now, I think there will be, you know, shopping experiences that, well, it needs to be that the headsets will be even more comfortable. We're down to about 250 grams, I think, somewhere there for Quest 3, which is pretty damn good. The Apple headset's, you know, quite a bit heavier. But I think, you know, like anything, you just kind of go, okay, we're here and the curve is like this. Or in terms of weight, it's like this, and cost, it's like this. So where are we going in 5 years? So I think it would be just like, hey, Marina, put on your headset or put on your glasses, and we'll be playing chess and looking at drawings. I'll show you some drawings. I'll draw it, but you'll be wherever you are, and I'll be wherever I am. So I think that's where I hope to be. That's the optimistic view of VR as something that brings people together.
You are one of these minority people that have both a creative brain and a business brain. And these two things have now come together over the last, 10, 15 years. For folks that are creative, that want to do things for themselves, they want to be, their own bosses, they want to have create their own businesses, they have ideas, but they might not have the business sense for it. Do you have any suggestions or tips or things they should be looking at? Or people they should be following. Like, what are your sort of like your go-to? Like, this is what you should do before you even start your business.
I have some very concrete advice for people to videos to watch and books to read. And like this is like, by the way, I have kids, right? So like think about try to be imagine my kids, like how, you know, like I'm always throwing them curveballs. But yeah, I think even especially because you're an artist. Okay, so first of all, there's a, you know, AI is kind of floating around. And I see a lot of artists and younger artists kind of like despairing. And I want to be optimistic about it. And I think, you know, don't despair. Because I think if you're truly creative and truly artistic, you'll just use it. And you know what? People's taste changes. So let the AI slurp up crappy concept art from the last 20 years and do something that surprises everybody. I don't know, make a, you know, I don't know, make an animation out of wild yarn and, you know, do that live on Twitch and make it awesome. I don't know, but I'm pretty optimistic that culture is a moving target, and I think if you're truly creative and artistic, you'll find a way. So that said, I do encourage any artist and creative to, get obsessed by stuff that's outside of your domain. I think that's, I mean, that's the way I operate. So I'm always like, I'm do this, but I read that. I read that, but then I do this. I'm always kind of crossing over boundaries. So if you want to know actually how the world works, there's a guy named Ray Dalio. He's got a bunch of YouTube videos. He's like in his 80s or 90s, I think, but he's one of the most brilliant investors ever. And he just explains macroeconomics in a way that's so succinct. And I wish I discovered him in my teens. So Ray Dalio, watch his videos, understand how the real world works of money and finance. In terms of books, I'm a big, I think I'm a little bit of, I like history, I guess, but also like the big picture. So anything, Yuval Harari, the historian, Sapiens is one book. He has another book called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. Read it and, really see what the world is like now. And it's moving so fast and technology changes, but at the heart of it, it's people and society. And there's a lot, that I think it's really good to get that sense. That's two, I guess. What's another one? Ray Dalio, Harari. I mean, I don't stop reading science fiction. I quite like science fiction still. And The Expanse is an 8-book series that I gobbled up in, I think, a year or something, over a year. I actually read the real physical books. That's a great series. The show, read the book and watch the show. And again, I think William Gibson still is my favorite author of all time. And if you get a itch for reading something that's not a romancer, his short stories called Burning Chrome is amazing. It's I still think, when I tell people when I first went to Japan, like I don't think I was seeing Japan for what it was, or Tokyo. Like I had the words of William Gibson in my eyeballs when I stepped off the plane and walked around Tokyo, and I still love Tokyo. So if, I mean, another advice is like go travel, meet people that's not in your culture, and do other things. And when I was doing art, there was no such thing as a professional concept artist. My rendering sucks, and I think all the best designers I know, like they're their rendering kind of sucks, but their ideas are amazing. I'm talking about the, I mean, okay, Sid Mead is different. Sid Mead renders and his design's great. But I think one of the pitfalls today is that you see so much stuff online on ArtStation. You really want to stand out. Don't look at other people's art. Go travel, go build furniture, read history and get ideas in your brain before you draw. And the people I hire, I can tell that they're amazing designers. Even if they're, if it's a paper sketch, or sorry, a pencil sketch, I can tell that their form language is fresh and unique, and he can, or he or she can, play that kind of creative jazz with me. And I think I see so many concept artists that their rendering is great and looks like some of the, every single piece I see on ArtStation, but I don't really want an illustrator. I want somebody to be able to throw the ball around creatively and bring in influences and ideas from their lives. So I think, reading and traveling.
You're so busy. I mean, like you're running a company, you're constantly trying new things and looking outside of, whatever you it is that you're doing for work, for influence and inspiration. How do you sort of break up your day though? I mean, it's got to, time management has got to be difficult.
I think I was born to be a millennial or something. Like I've got ADHD, so okay, I answer emails in the mornings. I do have some, client meetings through the week. It's taken me, until now to be able to create that room for myself. Like I probably about 2 hours in the afternoon when I just like I actually got to draw again for my game, and that's really great. Yeah, I mean it, I don't know. I'm not sure how I do it. Yeah. But like Marina, but this is like after a 50 year or 40 years of being in multiple industries. So I think, I'm really proud of my the people I know and the network I know. But they're like the best of the best out of like film or VFX and games and startups and tech. And through those people, you know, I'm always talking to them, my friends. I learn from them and grow and, you know, change as well. Like everything, I mean, so I think, you know, I'm in some ways I'm in a position to be harvesting the fruits of my labor now. So I don't know if I need to manage my day. I don't know. I just do what I do. But I think I'm not great at planning things. I do react to things. I'm very impulsive. So, you know, I think sometimes my impulsive stuff is, you know, doing something completely wacky and crazy next week. Or it's something like, you know, after 6 years of this thing, I'm impulsively jumping into a whole new industry with a whole new set of people. So, you know, I think that's yeah, I'm not a great example for planning.
Well, and you know, you talk about how there's no roadmap for your career. You know, you've ended up where you've ended up, and you know, in part because you've taken chances and you've been curious and you've experimented and tried things and taken leaps. Let's say, like for your kids, you know, you're in a position, your life and where you are now is much different than where your parents were and the life that they had. What for you, like, what do you hope to pass on to them?
Being I think from a Chinese background, I think it's really easy to kind of like, not easy. I mean, the cliche is like, you know, study, 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 homework, 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 get a job, get a job, get a job. And I think for many reasons, not just the fact that the world has changed, not just the fact that if you do have that artistic heart, you should definitely pursue it, whatever, in whatever shape or form, because life is short and you might as well do something that you like. So for my kids, I think those, and the third thing I think is, you know, making stuff. I do have always encouraged them to just make stuff and whatever it is, right? So I think that's not just because me being a romantic. I think that's me knowing this moment in time with AI around the corner, with I think a glut of, you know, any career path where you can rinse and repeat, where there's a solid answer, is susceptible to AI. So I think in that same, in, for all those reasons, personal satisfaction, for to defend against what I think to be a really disruptive technology that will change everything, I think staying creative, making stuff constantly, making new friends, make stuff with friends. That is really what the secret is that I hope to impart on my kids.
And that was our conversation with Wilson Tang, CEO and Chief Designer at Yumibao. You can find out more about Wilson's latest projects at their website at yumibao.com. The Sparkcast is a production of the Spark Computer Graphics Society. Opening and closing credits by Michael Edlund. Editing and additional production support by Joshua Peterman. For more about SparkCG and our upcoming events, visit sparkcg.org.